Thanks for tuning in to the Lean 911 podcast, where you'll have a voice directly from the Gemba. I will rely on my three decades of Lean successes, as well as my failures, to answer your most challenging questions regarding your Lean transformation. I'm your host, Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting, and the principal architect of the Danaher Business System. Looking forward to your questions. Now, let's go to the Gemba.
Hi, welcome to episode 59 of the Lean 911 podcast, and got my friend and colleague back, John Boucher, for, I don't know, John, what is this, the third or fourth time? I don't know.
I think it's the fourth one, Mark. Good morning. How are you?
Boy, you're starting to be more of a guest on my show than I am. John and I, again, just if you don't know John and I have very similar backgrounds in terms, but our paths crossed later in our career. But we're both mentored by Chihiro Nakao, who is the father of moonshine from Shingijutsu. John has a very storied career with General Electric and done some unbelievable things there. And both he and I were mentored by Nakao, but in a little bit different way. John is what I would call a super engineer and probably the number one protege, not probably, the number one protege of Nakao under the 3P moonshining. But that's not what John is limited to. You know, and I got more general lean knowledge from and experience from Nakao. I probably have been fired as many times as you have, John, from Nakao. But John is an absolute master at 3P and moonshine. But in a way, we're not going to talk much about that today because we'll do that in other episodes. But we're going to talk more about problem solving. And sure. As a matter of fact, this episode, I've already done, John, seven episodes on problem solving in the Lean 911 podcast, breaking them down into all the various different, you know, what's a leading and lagging indicator, how do you define a problem, all that. This one here, to me, is most likely the biggest problem I see with problem solving, in that the how we set our organization up to win in a problem solving setting. In most companies I see today put some neat posters on the wall, like we solve our problems at the lowest possible level. Operators are our best consultants, blah, 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 blah. But they don't do that. They have a framework set up, not only from training and time and resources, but they don't have the organization established to be able to affect change. So this episode, which is the problem solving eighth series in the problem solving series, that if you go back and look at all the different episodes, is about defining the span of control to enable problem solving. Okay. And I'm just going to start by asking John, what do you mean by span of control? What does that even mean?
So Mark, it's a great question. So to begin, maybe I take one step back. I think a good lean journey has equal focus on culture and technical. What I think you talk about problem solving seems to be something that is a little out of reach for most places. And I think one of the reasons is there's far too much focus on the technical aspect of lean or manufacturing, not enough focus on the organization. And so I like to see that balance. And I know that when you and I are coaching Lean Horizons clients, that's the approach. A little bit of technical coaching, a little bit of cultural coaching. Because without that balance, you'll get lopsided whichever way the scale is going to tip. And I don't think it's healthy for a good lean journey. So when I think about span of control, I think about failure modes. And so whether it's in a lot of shops in the company that I just came out of, the one you started with, or what you see with your clients, there's a lot of things in common. And I think it's the inability to understand how to organize around lean or problem solving. So when I think about span of control, the first thing I think about, Mark, is to try to dispel a myth. Or when somebody asks me about span of control, you might be setting up a new line. And I try to dispel that myth on, hey, there's no set number of people. It's not an equation that you have to fulfill or solve for. Span of control would be, how do you enable the problem-solving culture? realizing a few things. One, no problem solves itself and no one person can solve a problem. So that's point one. Point two, the problem doesn't care what function you work in. Almost always, the problems are cross-functional. Almost always, Mark. I think that it's probably something that you see in your experience too, right?
Well, how do you respond to some of the more notable lean people out there today who say that, okay, people say, well, how many Kaizen leaders do I need in my shop and my factory or my business or whatever? Yeah. And the answer usually comes out to be very formulaic. Like, for every 100 people, you need to have X number of this and X number of that and X number of that.
Yeah, here's my thinking. So this is point three.
How do you respond to that?
Yeah, so my thinking is actually the third point, is the number of people required to help you problem solve is in direct proportion to the number of problems you have to solve. It's that simple.
You mean to tell me that if I got five value streams, I shouldn't just populate them with the same number of resources?
Yeah, I would say that's a failure mode. The answer would be no, and it's a failure mode. So now we're back to one of your observations that people struggle to do real problem solving. And here's the first of many failure modes, is they try to apply a mathematical formula to how to organize inside the value stream.
So, John, talk to me more about the nature of a problem and what in the organization, from an organizational perspective, do you need to solve it? Okay. I don't know of any problem that I ever attempted to solve that didn't require a lot more than the resources I had under my feet.
Yep. And so maybe, Mark, I start out the conversation with a very basic element. And so for me, the basic element is to make sure that a team gets grounded on what is the definition of a problem. So when I talk about failure modes, now here's a second one that I'm kind of throwing out, is all too often a team will start down a pathway and they either won't understand what is meant by a problem, how do you define it, or they never got clarity on what they're solving for. So when I think about this, what is a problem? Here's my very basic way to think about it. It's a performance gap to a known standard. And so now, having said that, we have to peel the onion back a little bit more. And unless some basic standards are set up, problem solving is almost or would be impossible. So I go all the way back to these basic fundamental elements.
I was with a company a few days ago, and they had their Gemba board and they had their problems listed and all that. And I started asking about that. And the first question I asked was, the problems that you're showing here, could you show me the process that was violated?
Yeah.
Can you show me the standard that was violated?
That's right.
And they didn't have one.
Right. Yep.
So what I told them was, then I don't know why that's on the board, because that's not a problem. Yep. Not a problem. You didn't violate any standard. And they just looked at me. I said, no, you know what the problem is? The problem is you don't have a standard.
That's right.
Never mind adhering to the standard. You don't have one.
That's right. Mark, I love it. I love it. So it's either that's absent, or the way to define a problem, the way to understand how to look at it and define it before you approach it, or while you're approaching it, before you start the problem-solving process. Go ahead. Yep.
So I find a problem.
Yep.
And I tell my engineer, okay, go fix that problem. Go figure it out. Yeah. I mean, what's missing in that story?
Yeah.
I mean, what's missing? Yeah. I mean, you know, can the engineer do it by himself?
Yeah, nobody can do it by themselves. So I think that I actually think back to times where my better teams would, they executed very well, but they were also very cerebral. And I can remember having exercises on what are we solving for? Mark, sometimes it took a day. It took a day of dialogue. And what starts to come out is what you mentioned. Hey, if if we're doing a heat treat, do as a simple example, do I have a technical specification for it? Now, heat treat's real easy, but look, there's a lot of processes you and I see. As soon as you ask for a technical specification, they don't have it. And so without that, they'll end up chasing their tails unless they clearly define the problem. So to me, step one in a very big way is understand what you're solving for.
So John, I got to tell you a quick story on this, and I think I might have relayed this to you in the past. I can't disclose the client. A very large corporation. I was facilitating a problem solving. They wanted to learn CDAC, cause and effect diagram with condition of cards. I had 80 people in this class. 8 teams of 10. And almost to a person, at minimum, you had Six Sigma black belts, but most, I would say maybe 3/4 were Six Sigma master black belts. Whatever that means. Okay. I'm only a green belt and I don't even brag about it because anyway. We started out with problem definition on Monday morning. And I didn't get off till like after 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. They were highly upset with me because I was not letting them go forward. They did not know how to define a problem.
Yep.
The fundamentals of problem solving.
Yep.
And the fundamentals of how you think about defining the problem was not there. And they were extremely upset with me because I held them back and it was kind of an insult. Hey, we're master black belts. We know how to do this, right? Thursday came along and they came to me and said, Mark, we now see not all of them, but I would say a majority, 90% of them were very pleased. I was hard on them on Monday and did not let them go. If you're a Monopoly player, and collect their $200. They had to get that problem definition straight. Otherwise, what you got is you got a bunch of solutions that are fun to do, looking for a problem.
It always turns into that, Mark. It does. And the more smart people you have, the more susceptible you are to go down that path.
Hey, I think you know the company I'm talking about, and these people were extremely.
For sure. Yeah. I might be a master black belt out of the same company. So. And I think so.
I didn't say that, John. I didn't. Yeah.
You know, okay. if we're to be pragmatic about this, if you spend a good thorough day defining the problem, once you have that, then that next step is easier. On you should be able to see how the problem has no boundaries or it's cross-functional. The problem might originate in one place. They think it's in one place, but it actually has an extension. That goes across functions. And once the team can understand that, then it's much easier to understand who needs to be on that team to help solve the problem.
Wait a minute now. You mean to tell me that if I have a manufacturing problem, it's not just a manufacturing problem?
Almost.
If I have an engineering problem, it's not just a problem in engineering or HR? You know. If I have a problem in finance, it's just a finance problem?
You know, it's almost never.
John, you're being unreasonable here, aren't you?
Yeah. So again, the problem doesn't care what function you work in, or I would say it doesn't care what function you find it in. So most of the time, the function you discover it in is not the point of origin. So if we think about manufacturing, all the sins of the enterprise end up on the shop floor. And it's almost always like if you're an assembly shop, it's almost always at assembly. The sins of fill the blank in. So where you see it, a lot of people, I think, get tricked. They think the problem originates somewhere close to where you see it. And we know this as a client we've been working with. When they find a defect, they give the title of the defect to the name of the machine that caught it, right?
No. And that's not where the problem started.
Right. That's where they first see it. So I think a lot of people get tricked. And they start working in that function because that's where it showed up. And again, if the team were able to relax and have a good coach and first understand what is the definition of a problem, how do we know the problem, where does it originate, or how many functions did it pass through, then they stand a fighting chance to solve it because they're able to get the cross-functional team together.
So let's think, because remember now the title of this is eighth problem solving episode. Okay. Right. Now, when I started this, I had like four or five in my mind, and I say, oh, we're probably gonna have a few of these. Then it turned to seven. Now we're on eight, and we'll probably go to 20 when we're finally done, if we're done. And but the title of this is Defining Span of Control to Enable Problem Solving. So let me ask you this question. I've seen well, two things. One, when I was actually CFO, and I'm going to give an unrelated non-manufacturing example. We had three people in accounts payable. We actually established, John, standard work with combination sheets and everything, intact time, everything, to pay a bill, to invoice, okay? Mm-hmm. And the standard combination sheet said we needed roughly 0.8 of one person to do all the work that we had to do. Okay. And we had three product families. We had materials as a product family for the invoice. We had non-PO like electric bills and stuff like that, and expense reports. So we had three product families, but paying them was pretty much almost the same. Yeah. A few differences. So why do we have three people? We could not hold the standard. And the reason was the quality problems.
Yeah.
So we had missing purchase orders that we couldn't pay the bill, wrong unit of measures. We had no PO, no receiver. No. So we actually used problem solving and created a Pareto and went after all those problems. Now, guess what? None of those problems were accounting problems. They resonated in purchasing, in receiving, in engineering, in manufacturing.
I'm not surprised
none
at all.
None of them were accounting problems.
That's right. It just reinforces most of the time they show up in one function, but almost never did they originate there.
And I always question the manufacturing people who have to report their performance. Never do you see the design guy with them talking about quality.
That's
right. Never do you see the sales guy talking about a shitty forecast.
Yep.
Use my language, okay?
Yep.
Or bad market data that came into their SIOP process. That's if they had a SIOP process, okay? So now you see the manufacturing person standing there explaining all of this, and it's the wrong guy.
Yep.
Now, don't get me wrong. Manufacturing always has something to be accountable for, okay? Because they got their share of issues too. But how does this flow, John, into how you see value streams and how they should be created?
I love that question. So let's see. So what I'll try to do is express myself without a diagram. I'm a guy that loves to draw on whiteboards, but I think I can articulate it. So if we were to think about an operator, what is the role of an operator? Some of the issues begin there, Mark, where a lot of people might think, the operator is close to the process. They're the chief problem solver. No, that's almost never the case. So it's like a sports team. The operator has a position to play, but it's really not the problem solver. Insight, input, ideas, yes, of course. And so we start to think there, you think about team leaders, the organization gets bigger and bigger. If you think about the classical organization, and I'm not a historian, but I think organizations really began with a Roman army a very long time ago. Classic organization has everybody inside a pyramid working up toward the top. When I think about this, what I like to do is think in terms of value streams. And instead of this classical organization where there's one big pyramid pointed toward the top, I try to do a lot of separation. And so that separation, the reason for it, at least to me, is to help with problem solving. Everybody has a role to play in problem solving. So if the organization's too big, if one person has 2,000 people reporting into them, there's no way they can allocate enough time to problem solve. So Mark, if you think about that diagram, and I don't know if we ever have some slides that would accompany this dialogue, but is it called the Maslow diagram?
The Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
No, is it Maslow where you spend your time?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Those are always.
Remember that? Yeah, depending on where you are in the organization, where do you spend your time? So if you're an operator, You spend your time working toward the standards. If you're a line leader, it's making sure that people can work to the standards in a certain percentage, problem solving, so on and so forth. So what I try to do, and maybe we can include that diagram as part of this podcast, is I think about that diagram. It's very, very powerful. And so you think about the value stream organization. In the beginning, if a place is setting up lines, let's say you're doing your first few lines, what you want is you want the hierarchy. Every step in that hierarchy has a role in problem solving. That would be the escalation process, part of the daily management. So I tear the roles down. So instead of a plant manager, to me, it's value stream leaders. Now, if you have a huge facility that has a million square feet, you might need a custodian of the facility, somebody overall responsible for something. That's different. But the power of breaking into value streams is you have a core cross-functional team where everyone has a position to play, and the very top person that would be the value stream leader gets involved in problem solving daily.
So, John, let me ask you a question. You and I have been around the block for a few years. And
yeah.
How many companies have you walked into and see value stream maps on the wall, but the organization has not organized in a value stream fashion? What's the percentage? Anytime you saw a value stream map, how many companies actually organized into a true value stream?
Mark, it's going to be close to 100%. I can't say 100. I'm sure I've seen some exceptions like you. You have two things, I think. You have that phenomenon coupled with they might use the word value stream leader, but it doesn't have the definition that you and I would put to it.
So the value stream leaders that I've seen in my travels are people who just manage the operators or manage the supervisor.
Right.
And they don't have really a span of control relative to its quality, whether it's marketing, whether it's engineering, finance. You know, I had a client one time where this one lady who was a phenomenal lady ran a refurbishing department where they would take their parts, customers send them in to be refurbished, okay, rather than buy a new part. That was a unbelievable moneymaker for this company, right? Mm-hmm. She had no resources under her. She had no engineering. She had no quality. She's trying to get these things out to meet commitment dates, but the quality guy reported into the quality manager in the factory, and she had a vie for his time. She had no way to get him there because he was responsible. He was being tasked with satisfying his functional leader's priorities, not the customers. And so I, like you, have seen so many value streams created, which are just, to me, cartoons on a wall. They're cartoons. Yep. They're cartoons. They're all fictitious. All cartoons are fictitious, mm-hmm. right? These are cartoons because the way that you're saying this value stream is supposed to flow and supposed to work is not how you're organized. So you don't, as a value stream, if you want to be the value stream leader, you don't have any of these resources under you. So good luck with that. It's like, you know, because I think of a value stream is like a company within a company, if you want to think about it that way.
It has to be. So that's exactly, Mark. And I think one of the reasons that people don't do it is it's an exercise in decentralization.
So absolutely.
Therein lies the rub. Is somebody thinks they're going to be giving up their power or their job changes, but the people that are very successful with the lean journey take that step to decentralize. So it only works if the value stream leader has the cross-functional team. Occasionally, there might be somebody that's not part of that team. Yes, of course. But if you think about the nature of the problems when you're designing these value streams, and to some extent, they're designed around the nature of the problems that you will experience. Meaning, hey, I can't quite get a handle on my demand. I'm going to need somebody on the team that comes from that space. I've got issues over here with lack of definition on specifications. I need somebody from the technical space, so on and so forth. So this exercise almost always begins with the anticipation of what type of problems that you will be experiencing. And inside a, let's go to a factory, inside a factory, the value streams would not be identical. Again, it's all going to be based on how many issues you have to solve and what the nature of those problems are. So you might have one value stream that could have make crazy numbers up, but the proportions are most important. Five engineers, two people from sales, one person from service. We could map that out. A value stream on the other side of the plant might have a different makeup. It might have 10 maintenance people, five quality people, and two engineers, and no one from service and no one from sales.
So if I understand you right, John, you are basically saying it's the nature of the problems that are going to drive your organizational resources.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
All the nature and number of problems.
It absolutely, Mark, 100% spot on. So let's think about a lean journey timeline. Here's another trap I think people step into. The way you would organize for the first 2 years is different than the second two or the next phase. It might be 5 years. And so the team, just like doing layouts in the shop, they should be flexible enough and open-minded enough and be willing to change that organization as the lean IQ goes up in the factory, as the timeline progresses. The needs are going to change, and they should shift everything in response to that.
So, you know, back at Jake Break, when this all started with Danaher, I was there. We, we organized into value streams, if you want to call them that.
Mm-hmm.
And there were more product design teams where it was cross-functional. We had design engineering, manufacturing, we had finance, we had procurement, you know, all that, right? Commercial side of the business. And they stayed together in that design team throughout the whole design of the product. It's just that when you got to a certain part of the tollgate process, maybe when you got to the manufacturing part, that person took the lead of the team. But it didn't mean the design guy goes away. He's still on the team all the way through job one and then after, right? And when it got to the end and it's in production, and then all of a sudden then commercial took over as the lead of the team to deal with customer issues and all that and rollout. But we did have a situation, John, and you alluded to it, that, you know, because we would assign, even in the manufacturing side, tool and die guys, we assign maintenance, manufacturing engineers, buyer planners, materials people. And what we had a situation like with my finance team. We had probably 8 or 9, maybe 10 value streams, and I was going to put a dedicated finance person on every team. It didn't make sense. So maybe each one of my, what I call plant controllers, which I promoted to, had maybe 3 value streams they were accountable for. And they were responsible for all the meetings, do all the analysis, do the target costing, do the capital appropriation analysis, and challenge them on CARs and all that. So we did have some shared resources because it didn't make sense to populate everyone. But even with that said, the number of engineers on the Caterpillar cell was a lot more perhaps than on the Mac cell because of the
I couldn't agree more. And the faster an organization realizes that, the better their lean journey is going to be. So if we were to use a sports analogy, I'm not a huge team sports guy, but I've got two in mind. So American football, for people that may not be inside the U.S. listening to this, for American
people out there who are rugby fans and Australian rules football fans, they look at the American NFL football as, hey, guys, wear all that equipment. It can't be that tough.
Anyway, That's right. Yeah, I wouldn't want to be on the field. So look, let's say the way that the defense lines up, that's really a function of how the offense lines up, or vice versa, right? When you're playing a game, it's very fluid. We see that all the time during the game, right? And so the analogy there would be, okay, you've got your set of problems. That organization should be centered around your problems. Or in the sport of basketball, you've got zones where the offense and defense will go into different zones depending on what's the current state of the game. So again, the advice I would give everybody is just be really open-minded to this entire concept of how you organize around the type of problems, the depth of problems, and especially how your problem migrates across functions.
John, I've also seen this in the sales space, okay, mm-hmm. where we're going to do these geographic regions and we're going to put a salesperson in each region,
yeah.
where maybe one region that's heavily populated like Chicago or, you know, some big city.
Yep.
They treat it the same as they would Wyoming.
Everybody okay? does it. Yep.
Right. Yep. And so it's like, well, wait a minute now, you can really drive revenue in a more populated area, make more sales calls yep. per day, blah, 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 yep. by rethinking that. Okay. And it's just incredible that everything's thought of linearly, you know, which is not what you want. So,
no, yeah, go ahead.
John, you and I had a discussion the other day, and you have a very unique, in my opinion, and accurate view of a couple of things. And maybe I think these all kind of go together.
Mm-hmm.
What is John Boucher's definition of a standard? And what's your definition of, let's just bring it right down to manufacturing for a moment, of a manufacturing line or a cell? What's the definition of a process of a line, and why are standards needed? Why do we need standards?
I love it. So Mark, how I get this perspective, nobody taught it to me. Nobody told it to me. It was over the course of, coaching the setup of hundreds of lines, literally hundreds.
Right.
And then I started to think about this and put the pieces together every time. So one of the things I started to see, the real purpose of a line is to expose the waste or expose the problems. That's the core purpose.
The purpose, let's back up on
that. Yeah, go ahead.
That is profound.
Yep.
Because, John, I've never, ever, even with our Japanese senseis, and maybe with the exception of Kao, heard that before with the purpose of a line or a manufacturing cell is to expose problems. So you're telling me then that all you need is setting up the equipment and then you're all set? And the problems will be exposed?
So that's the start. So the standards are so important in... Mark,
go.
Maybe this is for another podcast, but I'll just dip my toe into how I think about standards. So recently, there's a Lean Horizons client that we're working day and night with. The team is great. And so not that long ago, they kept asking me, John, when are you going to help us with standards? And I thought that was a good day for me to get the whole team together and say, hey, I'm going to give you a list of 10 standards you already did. So those standards would be, Mark, it ranges from, did you define attack time? So there's a standard.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a standard lot size? Do you have a standard lead time? Do you have a standard way to move product from point A to point B? So these, so far, these are all integral to line setup. And I'll just kind of go back outside the dialogue. I think what was on their mind is they did not see a standard work combination sheet, and they were drawing the conclusions that they weren't doing standards. Having said that, I've seen a lot of places thinks that that's what's meant by standards, and they try to do it to leaders all day long too. If an operator has a standard work combination sheet, by default, a leader should have something that looks like that. And I for one, just don't subscribe to that thought process. So I don't know. That's my take on those two topics.
Okay. So you cannot do what you want to do with a line, which, to go back on what you said, if the purpose of a line is to expose problems, you are not able to do that if you do not have a standard for whatever it is you're measuring.
Yep, no matter what. And so let's just start to expand on that. Without that standard, you can't define a problem, because to me, the definition of a problem is, let's call it a performance gap to a known standard. meaning I needed to get this outcome and I got that outcome. So that's what I would call the performance gap. And so without that clearly defined standard, you can't get anywhere. And so what people might think is a problem is actually a phenomenon, meaning it's an occurrence that you can't define. You can see it. It doesn't mean you can define it or act on it. So we're all the way back to where we began, right? So if the line is a tool to expose your problems, we're back to the core of this is it always is the standard first is the most important thing. And then the standard helps you define the problem. The organization helps you solve the problem. That organization has to be smaller than almost everything we see today and more focused and put together based on the nature and the depth of the issues that you're going to have.
There's a guy that we know.
There's a guy, yep.
Named Tiashi Ono, who is the father of the Toyota Production System. I probably can't say he agrees with you because I think you probably agree with him.
Yes, of course.
But without standards, there can be no improvement.
Yeah.
There you go.
What okay? A profound statement, isn't it? Just profound.
Yeah. And I'll tell you a quick story. You might have heard this before, but I went out to see a company out in St. Louis, a chemical company, and the CEO of this company was, anyway, he had me stand in front of 30 of his executives and people in his company. And in front of everybody, he said, "Mark, how do we get these people to engage and how do I get them to stop making mistakes?" He said that right in front of them. Okay. And I said, so now I'm in front of these 30 people. Okay. And I'm trying to like, okay, well, what do I say? Right. Felt bad for the people. They were good people. So I looked at the CEO and I said, "How do you know they made an error?"
Wow.
And he said, "Well, it's obvious. Wow. Everybody knows you don't put nitric acid next to a barrel of whatever," because he was a chemical engineer. Apparently, I said, not everybody knows.
Yep.
Because it happened. So I just want to know, though, is there a specification or a process that tells you that you can't do that? Is your shop floor configured in such a way where it's impossible to put those two chemicals together? And by the way, this wasn't the only problem he was complaining about. He just used this as an example, okay? I said, I'm going to submit to you, Mr. CEO, that your people did not make an error. Because you can't point to a standard that they violated. There's no errors here. Not unless you could read minds like Kreskin. And then I said, okay, wait a minute, I'm dating myself because Kreskin, a lot of the younger people didn't know who Kreskin was, the mind reader, right? Unless they can all read minds, then you're all set. You don't need to write anything down. Okay. But if it's in your head, and I said, now let me ask you this question. How many chemical engineers are in this room? Three of them raised their hand. How many people knew about this particular issue of the engineers? Only two of the three raised their hand. So here we got a chemical engineer who doesn't know. Okay. And I'm not trying to say it's bad, but it's a nuance. And if it's something that's so critical and so dangerous and proposes such a safety hazard, boy, we're just relying on people to do the right thing. Yeah. I wouldn't want to fly an airline that way. Okay.
No, okay. Nobody would. Nobody would.
So your point about standards, John, is so on the mark. So let me ask you this question. You just go out and create standards on everything on day one? What do you do? How do you think about that?
Boy, that's the tough part, isn't it, Mark? It is. Mm-hmm. It is. So even as a coach, right? As a coach, how do you sift through everything that you're staring at with all the issues that people are giving you and get started? And what I would say, and you know, I'm a practitioner, so in very practical terms, it's never the same approach. And so that starting point is never the same. It's always situational. And that drives people crazy. If we say it, right? You and I say it is situational, but Mark, it's so true. And so one of the ways I start is I start by, again, thinking about a failure mode, failure modes of lean journeys. All too many tend to be tools-based. I would call tools-based. Hey, you guys need to do Kanban. You need to do this. You need to do that. And if you think about Teachy Ono's quote, it didn't say anything about tools. It's the thinking behind these concepts. So I think, to answer your question, it's kind of a long answer and a, you know, maybe an odd way to get there. But understanding what are the concepts and what's the thinking behind the tools? Where do we need to begin? And in that case, I try to begin at the simplest level that I possibly can. And when I say simple, it's not technical simple. It's culture simple. I'm searching for that one place or the one process or the one something that people can gravitate toward. It tends to be visual. It tends to be something that everybody can see and understand. And we begin there because when we talk about learn by doing, you're creating the working classroom. And so I don't pick anything that's too difficult or tends to be abstract. I wouldn't even call it a case study, but let's grab something that everybody can come together on, look at the same way, and it won't take that long. So they do something, they see a good outcome, they do something, they learn, they do something, they're able to take the next more difficult step.
So, John, would you say that some of these bigger problems that are way too broad, that people need to understand how to look at those problems more as maybe a half a dozen problems as opposed to one big problem?
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of whether it's decentralization or breaking things down. So I have a phrase that I use that the company I retired out of, everybody knows I use this phrase, especially when we get into moonshine, and I call it compartmentalization. So basically, it's learning how to tear something really complex down into simple pieces. So maybe one way to think about it is define the subassemblies of the problem. What are those more discernible or definitive pieces of the bigger problem? And once you do that and you break it down into something that's simpler, look, you've got fewer variables to contend with. The problem solving becomes a little easier. And one of the things that I think people, they might resist this approach because instead of what they thought was one problem becomes eight. It doesn't mean it's not solvable. Actually, you will solve it if you learn how to break it into smaller pieces.
Well, you know, John, when I go look at Gemba boards and they're measuring, let's say on-time delivery for the factory, it's like, wait a minute, you got eight value streams here or supposed value streams. You've got, so which product, which customer, which value stream, and what you have are these grandiose macro level lagging indicators. You cannot solve the problem that way.
Always lagging. And you know what? So now you get me going, Mark. I know we're 43 minutes into this. Mark, when I think about, especially in my study missions to Japan. We all did it, right?
Yep.
Study missions were incredible. And I think back on it, I didn't see these so-called Gemba boards at the best places on the planet. I didn't see them.
Nope.
Right. And I think two things. It could be it never was part of the Toyota production system. I think this is something fabricated by consultants to tell you the truth. But the best in the world have progressed to the point where the problem solving tends to be real time. They're not looking at yesterday's news.
So, John, our friend Nikau, one time I was with a new acquisition and the quality guy brought him a quality report from Quality Problems from the previous week.
Yeah.
And you heard this story before, but I'll tell it to the, and I might've said it on another episode. Nikau just took the report, ripped it up, put it in a big ball, a wad of paper, threw it on the ground and stomped on it. And the quality guy's just sitting there looking at him. Yeah. And he looks at the quality guy and says, what did you have for lunch today? I had a hot dog. Okay. What'd you have for lunch for yesterday? I had pizza. What'd you have for lunch for last Tuesday? Geez, I don't remember. You can't tell me what you had for lunch last Tuesday. What the heck good are these, this quality data that's a week old? And what they taught us was, you want to solve a defect? Let's say it's a manufacturing defect. Go ahead, go make one right now. Go make a defect right now.
So in fact, the way I think about it, the only way to know for sure that you have found and solved the problem is to create the defect again on demand. That's
and
the
acid test. On demand. You know how hard that is?
That's the acid test. And so my old team knows that. They know it. So especially when we get into TPM, they were talking about machine failures. They might say, I found the problem. Okay, let's see it. Make a defect. Make the problem occur.
Yep. Who owns problem solving? You come up with a problem, whether it's in a value stream, whether it's in, you know, the administrative offices, whatever. Who owns problem solving? And what is the role of the operator? Do we allow the operator to just go and figure it out themselves because we want to solve at the lowest level? And what does the operator need, and what does the team need? And from a framework, from a support perspective, what are your thoughts on that? Who owns it? Role of the operator? What kind of framework do you need? What kind of resources do you need?
Yeah. And so, Mark, I think back as a way to get at this. I just think back from my old boss, somebody in GE that I worked for, I don't know, four or five different times. Look, mm-hmm. We're very good friends. You know him. And without even knowing it, one of the things he taught me is how to put cross-functional teams together and how to solve problems. With mm-hmm. or without Lean, just in general, he had a really big job. But he was always making sure that he had cross-functional teams together. So when I think about who owns a problem, I think in a classical sense, there's mistakes that people make. Let me start there. Because somebody thinks a problem is a quality problem, they assign it to quality people. You know how this goes. So that's that functional assignment. I discourage that. And so just because a problem might look like it's technical doesn't mean a technical person owns it. So if it's not fair that I just leave it like that. So I discourage that approach. The approach that I encourage is first to ask for volunteers. So when we talk about problems, now there's two types, right? You've got one that might happen right now on the line. An operator, if you're in assembly, might have trouble with a bolt. That's a different something. That's more of a response in a direct aid where somebody would help solve that immediate problem. That's a tactical solution. So we're talking about problems that are bigger. And so what we work on is usually discussed at a team level. And it might be in a stand-up meeting on the shop floor. It might be, let's say, a Friday review or something where we talk about the problems. What I like to see is that first, the leader would ask for volunteers. Hey, we know we need to work on this. Who would like to work on it? So that'd be the first. Who would like to lead this cross-functional team? Then second, who would volunteer to be on the team? So to me, that's the ultimate, if you can get that far. So now what we have is who owns it. So if you are Mark, let's say you're the vice president of manufacturing. To follow up in a few weeks, you would ask the person that you assigned this to. It doesn't necessarily mean that's the person that solved it. That person was assigned to help that cross-functional team solve that problem. So it's always the cross-functional team that would own the solving of the problem. The leader of that team would own the organization around it, the communication around it, the operating mechanisms around it, and the reporting about what they found and how they solved it and how this goes forward. And then the person that has the biggest job, I think, would own the follow-up to that, making sure that the problem got solved, things got closed out. So that's kind of my response to piece one. And if we talk about the role of the operator, I think all too often, everything gets dropped in the operator's lap. Mark, let's think about this. So how many factories have you gone through when somebody says, oh, the operator does the TPM in the morning? Okay. Oh, the operator generates ideas for Kaizen. Okay. Oh, the operator helps me with all the safety solutions here. Okay. And pretty soon, if you add all that up, the operator doesn't have enough time to perform their standard work combination sheet and produce the tack time. So look, I think the first thing to avoid would be the tendency to drop everything into the operator's lap. The operator is there as a resource, but their primary function is production. Yeah, occasionally they get pulled out. But I see the role of the operator would be, let's call it the role of an advisor. Hey, what did you experience? When did you experience? You have any input for me? I think maybe just this, the fewest words I could put to both of those. Hopefully I gave a sufficient answer to your question.
John, we have a little technical difficulty here. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, you were talking about the role of the operator and the and how you think about formulating those teams. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, and I think everything got recorded. I was watching the recording, was still going.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so the bottom line is, yeah, you want operator involvement. They're the closest to the problem. They may provide some invaluable input. But it's not enough, is it?
No, you need a cross-functional team. So two things. It's not just the operator. And you need a cross-functional team. So I go back to, I like the operator to be an advisor. Yeah, they're the people closest to the action. We say an operator, Mark. It could be, look, if it's a materials problem, it's somebody that is intimate with the process itself. I know we always say operator, but it doesn't always have to be an operator. So no matter what, it's the cross-functional team that really helps everybody win. There's no other way around it. So organizing cross-functionally, problem-solving cross-functionally, thinking cross-functionally, understanding that your problems are almost never functional. I think those realizations are important for anybody's lean journey.
Well, John, this has been great. You know, I'll maybe leave with a little bit of a case study on a problem that we had in one of our divisions in Danaher over in England.
Mm-hmm.
And their biggest problem was on their test stand. They're making temperature controllers. And the biggest item on the Pareto for defects was called no fault found.
Yeah.
They would test the product. It would fail. They look at it and test it again, and it would pass. Through further analysis, they found out, hey, look, all these parts are good. So we got a problem here on our test. Something's going on, and they couldn't figure it out. So the group president of that whole group said, Mark, you got to go to England and help these guys because they're not doing it. Now, granted, you know, I'm not an engineer. Okay. And so what happened was I fly over to Brighton, England, and I get the room together. And the first question I asked was, who was involved in this problem solving endeavor that was dragging on for months? It was only the engineers.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm not surprised.
Did you involve the operators? Did you involve somebody who knows nothing about this problem that can ask the dumb questions?
Yeah.
So anyway, long story short, I got the group together. I was actually performing a C-deck on this one. And one of the operators says, hey, this problem doesn't happen on the weekends. Really? That just caught me. Okay. If you're not familiar with C-deck, people out there, you know, maybe we'll do an episode on it. But what first thing you do is collect what we call fact cards. And I use that word loosely because the facts could be your opinion, could be an observation. Well, this is one of the fact cards. And the operator said, hey, it doesn't happen on the weekend. So we started digging into it. That really fascinated me. Why does this problem go away on the weekends, right? To make a long story short, there's a company, an unrelated company, who shared the same building, but there's a wall between us. And they had a process that had intermittent testing, and it would set EMF, help me out, John, electromagnetic frequencies over to our facility. And it was playing havoc with our test system, our test equipment. But it only happened when they were running that process, and it was all intermittent during the day. So I called up that company. I said, let's get in touch with the guy running that thing. We all went over there as a team, looked at what's going on. We had somebody on the other side, and okay, he's running the test now. Test the part. Yeah, it failed. Now he's not running it. Test it again. It didn't fail. We did this several times. So the solution that they came up with was to put some type, I don't know what it was made out of, copper or something, whatever.
They
put
a lead barrier
shield over, over the test equipment, and the problem went away.
Yep.
Bottom line on this, though, was if the operator made that observation.
Right.
They weren't right. And I swear to God, the attitude of the engineers was, what are they going to know?
See?
We're engineers.
Yep. So, Mark, I love that, because let's take that into pieces. In a lot of the shops that I've been to, people will drop things into the operator's lap, meaning, well, you're the operator, you should know and tell me. So they might not have the technical ability, but in that case, without interviewing them, like, you're a detective. So you're a detective and you're doing interviews and you're trying to find clues.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Without that, the team can't get anywhere. But that all the more reason why I need a cross-functional team is everybody brings expertise to the party. So the operator brings observation skills, right? And some a priori knowledge about the process.
Well, you better believe they brought observation skills, you know. Yep. And you know, I'm just amazed of the arrogance of not talking to somebody who's experienced that problem every single day.
Yeah.
You know, John, this has been great.
We covered a lot. Yeah.
Well, we can go on forever. And I think there's probably more follow-ups coming off of this thing. I'll be interested in what people think, because people write to me about these episodes and they ask questions and some give suggestions. Hey, why don't you take us further into this, you know, avenue or what? And on this one, I'm sure that's going to happen. However, John, I want to leave you with one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I love my attention that every time we solve one problem, we create two more. From now on, all problem solving is forbidden.
I love that.
And you want to know something? The way some companies solve problems, that's probably sage advice.
It's probably a good thing. Great, Mark. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for letting me express some of my thoughts. You know how passionate I am about the toolkit.
No. It was phenomenal. I hope people can start thinking about how to organize. Let's just summarize a little bit. The value stream needs to have full responsibility for all their, have access to all the resources required.
Yeah.
Whether or not they're shared resources or direct resources, you can't solve problems in a singular mindset or function. Second, there are no ratios. There's no ratios that says, for every 100 people, you need this many engineers.
Right.
For every 100 people, you need X percent of your lean people on the ground. There's none of that.
Very important.
You're telling me, John, is that it should be the types of types and when I say types, I'm talking about the depth and the complexity and also the number of problems that should dictate those resources. And that configuration, let's say you get it right off the bat, which you probably won't, but you'll get close, is going to change in a year or two.
Always. It always should change. Yep.
So there's no formulaic magic. There's no silver bullet. And I guess we can just maybe we should have called it this to begin with. Thinking is required.
Always. Deep thinking. And actions. It's got to be equal. But without that thinking, without understanding what's behind the concepts, the people won't get where they need to be.
John, this was awesome. This was our eighth episode on problem solving. I have a feeling we're going to be back with a few more. Defining the span of control to enable problem solving is kind of like the subject. But as you all could see, we touched on a lot of different things above and beyond what this title suggests. So most likely, John and I will go back and look at this video and say, hey, we need to do an episode here. We need to expand a little bit more on this. Because as John said, this is a Venn diagram. Lean is a Venn diagram. Consultants like to sell tools. Hey, we're going to come in and do standard work. And next week, we're going to do 5S. And next week, we're going to do SMED. And oh, yeah, by the way, don't forget about value stream mapping. And we know by working with Toyota that they look at this all of an eclectic type process. And John, my first visit to Japan, and people have heard me say this a million times, I'll continue to say it. I just said it yesterday to a potential client. Toyota told us in Toyota City, Japan, the difference between a world-class company and one that's not is their ability to solve problems.
I agree.
And he said,
wholeheartedly agree with that.
Yeah, and then he went on to say, even the great Toyota has problems.
Yep.
But we only solve our problems once.
Isn't it profound?
I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Mark.
This was episode. Yeah, John, thank you. John Boucher, you can send me any kind of questions you have for me or John at mark@lean911.com or directly to John. John, J-O-N, Boucher, B-O-U-C-H-E-R, John, J-O-N dot Boucher at leanhorizons.com or get me at mark.leanhorizons.com. Either one works. If you want to use mark@lean911, it might be easier. mark@lean911.com. Let us know what you think. Let us know your thoughts. Let us know your questions. And John, until next time, this was episode 59. And I really appreciate your time on this one. And we'll talk to you soon. Everybody out there, stay lean.
Thanks for listening to the Lean 911 podcast. I'll be happy to address your questions or feedback on future episodes. Email me at mark@lean911.com. You can check out our other episodes by visiting our website at lean911.com, our YouTube channel, wherever you listen to podcasts. This is your host, Mark DeLuzio. Thanks for listening.